Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. There's no better known battle of the Civil War, or perhaps in history, than Gettysburg. Between the battle itself, often seen as the turning point in the war, and the address President Abraham Lincoln gave there weeks later, it has become an integral part of the American experience and memory. We've spoken of the battle itself in the past on this show, but this week we'll talk about how the Battle of Gettysburg is remembered. And after that, Alan Weisberg takes on the myths and legends surrounding the Indian princess Pocahontas. But first, Joyce Gidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
On this day in history, November 29, 1947, the United Nations General Assembly passed Resolution 181, recommending the partition of Palestine and the creation of an independent Jewish state. From the early 20th century, both Jews and Arabs claimed territory in British Mandate-controlled Palestine. Many Jews were Zionists, arriving in the territory from Europe and Russia with the intent to form a Jewish national state. In reaction to this influx of Jews, indigenous Palestinian Arabs attempted to prevent Jewish immigration, seeking instead to create a secular Palestinian state. The situation escalated into open hostility in the late 1920s. The British, in an effort to appease the Arabs, limited Jewish immigration. But during World War II, as a result of the Holocaust, many Jews entered Palestine illegally, forcing Britain to turn to the United Nations. UN Resolution 181 gave the Jews their own land, and when the British withdrew their forces on May 14, 1948, Jewish Agency Chairman David Ben-Gurion proclaimed the State of Israel.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, an American researcher believes he has found the site of the fabled ancient civilization of Atlantis. Explorer and mythologist Robert Sarmast believes the island lies off the southern coast of Cyprus. Using sonar technology, ocean mapping techniques, and ancient texts, Sarmast has published maps to show where he believes Atlantis is located. The legend of the civilization originated in ancient Egypt and Greece, and was described by the philosopher Plato in his dialogues The Timaeus. Atlantis was wealthy and powerful, but it was eventually defeated by Mother Nature in the form of a massive flood that overwhelmed the island. Sarmast, who has published his findings in his book Discovery of Atlantis, The Startling Case for the Island of Cyprus, said, "We're set to make the greatest archaeological discovery of all time." Within his dialogue, Sarmast continued, Plato provides factual clues as to what Atlantis was like. I've matched all but two of the 45 clues with the area around Cyprus. Others, however, believe Plato's writings are allegorical and ought not to be taken literally. We shall see who's right. Stay tuned to Talking History for updates.
Gettysburg is a battlefield. It is also a shrine from the American Civil War. But has the place of the Battle of Gettysburg in our memory changed over the past 140 years? That's the subject of Jim Weeks' new book and of his conversation with Talking History's Jim Madison, professor of history at Indiana University.
What is Gettysburg? What happens when we go to that Civil War battlefield? Family vacation, mystical experience, history lesson, patriotic trembling, just fun. Do we experience that special place as earlier generations of Americans experienced it? Our guest on Talking History is Jim Weeks, who is a fellow at the Papers of Abraham Lincoln Project in Springfield, Illinois. Dr. Weeks is the author of Gettysburg, Memory, Market, and an American Shrine, published recently by Princeton University Press. Welcome, Jim Weeks.
Thank you, sir.
You begin your book with a very interesting description of your family's trips to Gettysburg in a black 53 Ford. What was it like then, in the 1950s, for your family and for the thousands of other American families who went to this battlefield?
Well, I think Gettysburg at the time had plenty of vestiges of the earlier era that had been shaped by veterans. There were monuments and carriage avenues, actually over 1,000 monuments that veterans had placed there to memorialize their service on that field. But by that time, by the 1950s, all the veterans were gone, and they no longer came back to visit their monuments, and they no longer came back to tell stories about the battle. And so the Park Service was trying to tell the story of the battle by creating turnouts for motorists. The carriage avenues were not really fit for automobiles, and the Park Service was trying to make the transition to an automobiling public. So they were putting up these displays that illustrated with maps and photos and so forth what had happened at particular spots, because monuments didn't make sense to the motoring public, as they had made sense to the veterans and those who visited during the Victorian era.
But what else did families do? I mean, they drove through the boulevards, they read some
right.
of the monuments.
Right, and there was plenty for families to do. There were motels with swimming pools that had replaced the old hotels, which had been in town. There were waxworks. One pundit from the Washington Post said that if wax dummies could vote, Gettysburg would be the 51st state. And then to reflect the invasion of television in the American suburbs, there were places like Charlie Weaver's Wax Museum. Charlie Weaver was a television personality. And there was also Fantasyland, which looked suspiciously like Walt Disney, Walt Disney's Disneyland and Walt Disney's television programs with Cinderella and so forth.
So I'm not sure I understand the connection between Gettysburg as a battlefield and Fantasyland as a Disney-like place in the 1950s.
Well, families like pilgrims 500 years ago on the road to Canterbury not only wanted to have a deep experience, they also wanted to be entertained. They're on family time, on family vacation. They want to bond. And they bond around what interests the children, as well as what the parents want to do. Responsible parents want to take their children to a place where they can develop the children's patriotism. But they want to also entertain the children. So kids need a place to go. And
right.
Fantasyland was that place. And there was also a Fort Defiance next door to Fantasyland, which reflected the great rage for the West at the time.
Right. I recall, I believe, that Jackie Kennedy brought the kids there several times?
Yeah, she brought the kids to, I think, three times she brought the kids to Fantasyland.
What about souvenirs?
Well, souvenirs in the 1950s, at least, were very important. They were very important to me because Gettysburg was the only place that I knew of where you could buy those corny little felt cappies and the little Confederate flag and the fake belt buckles, and they almost had a talismanic power to help a kid enter the past. They were objects, very much like reenactors use objects, to plunge into the past.
Right. Were other Civil War battlefields in America like Gettysburg in the 50s and 60s?
No, I think Gettysburg is unique.
Why? What?
Well,
what?
I place Gettysburg in the category of a shrine, rather than just a battlefield. And by shrine, I mean it's an exaggerated place that has values on the extremes. It has, on the one hand, it expresses our deepest reverence, and on the other hand, it's our extreme commercial values.
Yes, we want to get to those commercial values. I want to comment, though, on the very handsome dust jacket of your book, Gettysburg, Memory, Market, and an American Shrine. You have a postcard that looks like it's from the 40s or so. Gettysburg, the nation's greatest shrine, the postcard says. Would you go along? Would you go that far, the nation's greatest shrine?
Well, it's close to it. I mean, we're a nation, relatively young nation. We don't have any sacred cities or ancient shrines. We don't have a Mecca or Rome or Santiago de Compostela. The closest thing we have to sacred sites like those is Gettysburg and a few other places. I think Niagara Falls might be one, Gatlinburg, Statue of Liberty. And Gettysburg is one of those unusual places, and I think it's the history of its development as a shrine tells us more about the American people than the battle itself.
Right. And let's get to that by talking now about how Gettysburg has changed in the last 40 or 50 years, how it's different in the early 21st century from what it was in the 50s when you went there with your family as a tourist.
I think it's changed dramatically because we no longer find the family entertainments anymore, but Gettysburg has become a themed attraction.
So Fantasyland is gone?
Fantasyland was swept away many years ago. I can't remember exactly the year, but Fort Defiance, Fantasyland are gone. And everything now is themed toward the Civil War and what I call a segmented market of heritage tourism.
Can you explain that a little bit, heritage tourism?
Yeah, by heritage tourism, I mean that heritage tourism is not synonymous with history. Heritage tourism is tactile. It's experiential. What it does, it tries to create an environment of the past and then plunge people into that environment to give them an experiential sense of the past.
So is this where we get then to the reenactors?
Yes. But in addition to the reenactors, the Park Service has been trying to restore the battlefield as closely as possible to its 1863 appearance by restoring farm lanes that had been there, by restoring Virginia worm rail fencing that had been there, and so forth. We can't remove the monuments, of course, but other features of the landscape that were there at the time are being restored.
And this, of course, relates, I suppose, to the tower controversy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the tower was, I think, a pivotal moment in the history of the battlefield. That more or less culminated the whole battle against commercialism at Gettysburg when it went up in the early 1970s.
Maybe you can describe that tower for those who have not seen it.
Yeah, it was over 300 feet tall, and it looked very much like the Space Needle that was created for the Seattle World's Fair. It was very much an intrusion on the historic landscape.
You could really see it from all over the battlefield, as I
recall. For miles away.
Yeah, yeah.
It dominated the landscape.
And what happened to the tower?
The tower came down in the year 2000 on the anniversary of the battle, as a matter of fact. And that made the fans of the battlefield, the enthusiasts, very happy, of course.
So this is a movement toward this authenticity that you're talking about.
Yes, yes. Yes. To what's called that ugly neologism, the view shed, to purify the view shed. But I see the view shed as that whole idea of purifying the view shed is very similar to what Disney does with his African savannah, with his African village, with an English street scene from 1750, with all those environments. Gettysburg is just following suit.
So how do you deal then with the question that is Gettysburg now more real, more authentic than it was in the 1950s?
Well, there's an attempt. Authenticity is our monument, is the monument of the 21st century to Gettysburg, just like granite monuments were the the way veterans wanted to remember the battle. It's our desperate effort to try to reclaim the past.
But is it real? Is
well,
it authentic?
It's airbrushed reality. It's airbrushed in the sense that when these farm lanes are restored, they're not restored with human and animal litter and the garbage dumps that were possibly there or discarded agricultural equipment that was there. I mean, the restored environments look the way we want the past to look, in other words.
So this is the imagined past.
This is the imagined past, yeah. Right. And reenactments are the imagined battle, of course, not the real battle with all its horrors.
Talk a little bit about that, because reenacting seems to me to be very, very popular.
It is popular, but I see it as, while reenactors do have a certain claim on having educational value for the public, I think it's mostly for the reenactors. That is, what reenactors want to do is get that flash, that sense of being there. Being there on that hot July day and experiencing what it was like. They want to experience that fear and a sense of what was a Civil War battle really like.
So are they doing history, in your judgment? Is this history?
I think it's their way of trying to experience the past, but I don't see it as having a great deal of value for the public.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the public is really understanding the Civil War with all its complexities. And reenactors don't want to restore the entire event the way it really was, like the airbrushed landscape. Reenactors don't want to restore slavery, and they don't want to restore the horrible deaths and wounds
right.
that came out of the Civil War.
Let's continue with that area, because there's been a lot of commentary that when you go to Gettysburg and similar places, you seldom see many African-American tourists. Can you talk about that? What is the place of African-Americans in this battlefield, in this shrine, past and present?
Well, no African-American troops or – well, let me back up. A couple of amateur historians – have said that there were African-American troops at Gettysburg, but not more than one or two or three scattered here and there. There were no organized regiments of United States colored troops.
Though for those who don't know much about this war, there were such regiments, correct?
Yes, correct.
Yes.
Correct.
So they just were not at Gettysburg.
Right, they weren't at Gettysburg. However, beginning around 1890 or so, up until the end of World War I, 1918, thousands of black excursionists came to Gettysburg every year on their Emancipation Day, which was the day the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation was issued in September of 1862. So in September of 1862, thousands of black excursionists would ride the train up to Gettysburg and have an outing for a day, and this event was sponsored by the black GAR posts of Baltimore, the Grand Army of the Republic Veterans Organizations in Baltimore.
So they were connecting Gettysburg with emancipation, with the end of slavery.
Yes, yes.
But that is now missing, are you saying?
Well, I think, for one thing, blacks back then rode the rails, and railroads were discontinued. Passenger service finally ended in the 1940s completely to Gettysburg. But the automobile superseded the railroad as the means of tourist transportation to Gettysburg.
Right.
And few African Americans could afford cars. I think that's one reason why the black pilgrimages to Gettysburg stopped. And also, of course, the black veterans died out and stopped sponsoring the GAR excursions right. to Gettysburg. But I think now that Gettysburg is a heritage attraction, heritage is something that attracts the middle class buff, the middle class enthusiast, the enthusiast of battlefield touring, the reenactor. It's basically a white middle class place. I mean,
right.
you know, even the Park Service admits that.
Right.
And I think heritage has a lot to do with that.
Right. Well, we've gotten into some, but not all, of the many complexities and the very, very interesting questions and issues that are raised in a new book by Jim Weeks, Gettysburg, Memory, Market, and an American Shrine. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, sir.
For our commentary of the week, we turn to the legend of Pocahontas, one of the best-known Native Americans in American history. But once again, how much of what we've been told is actually true? That is the subject of this week's Talking History Commentary by Alan Weisberg.
We will explain the truth about a young girl named Pocahontas. She was a daughter of a powerful chief, Powhatan. She led an incredible short life. The name Pocahontas had many meanings, the naughty one or child whom you can never find because she's out playing somewhere, were two of the names. Her original name was Matuaca. The legend is she saved John Smith from being killed by her father in 1607. That would have made her 10 or 11 at that time. Pocahontas is remembered as the example of a good Indian, the one who saved a white man. The truth is that Smith told the story 17 years after it would have happened. In an account Smith wrote just after his stay with Powhatan's people, he never mentioned the incident. Smith's fellow colonists described him as an ambitious, self-promoting mercenary. The true Pocahontas story had a sad ending. In 1612, at the age of 17, Pocahontas was kidnapped. Ruffians from Jamestown kidnapped her for concessions from her important father. The men held her for more than a year. Her youth was taken in that year. During captivity, John Rolfe took interest in the pretty young prisoner. During these captivities, many colonists would spend the night. Rolfe fell in love with her, and she with him, eventually. She agreed to marry Rolfe, who the world will thank later for commercializing tobacco. They married on April 5th, 1614, in Jamestown City, Virginia. She accepted Christianity and was baptized Rebecca. They had a son named Thomas. In the spring of 1616, Rolfe took her to England. One occasion, she encountered John Smith, who was in London, too. She was furious with him. She turned her back to him and went off by herself. That's Indian for you are shut out. The Rolfes set off for Virginia in March of 1617. She was very ill. An English people's disease had taken her life. She was taken off the ship at Gravesend. She died there on March 21st, 1617, at the age of 21. She was buried in the church at Gravesend, England, on March 17th, 1617.
You've been listening to Alan Weisberg, author of the forthcoming book, The Principal People, A True History of the Cherokee Indians. And finally, for our site of the week, we continue on the subject of Pocahontas by calling to your attention a virtual site on the first permanent British colony in North America, and a colony in the heart of Pocahontas' homeland, Jamestown, Virginia. Here to tell you about the site is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
Virtual Jamestown is an ambitious web project that explores the legacies of the Jamestown settlement and the Virginia experiment during the period from 1570 to 1720. The site, as both a digital archive and a teaching resource, offers visitors the opportunity to explore the founding of Jamestown and to follow the complex and at times unexpected interactions of Europeans, Africans, and Indians over the next century. It includes maps and images, court records, labor contracts, first-hand accounts, newspapers, and other documents. Each resource section offers a good introduction. Several prominent scholars have contributed excellent interpretive essays, and visitors to the site will have the option of viewing the documents in their original form or with modern spelling. To visit Virtual Jamestown, go to the University of Virginia website and keyword search for Jamestown.
And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We invite your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beattie, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History and the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.